In this episode, I'm joined once again by the author Chad Haag to discuss his book, The Later Philosophy of Pentti Linkola. In this episode, we discuss the deep ecology of Pentti Linkola alongside discussions on the environment, sustainability, consumerism, and ecology. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Emetics podcast or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy.
So, Chad Haag, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are discussing your book, The Later Philosophy of Pentti Linkola. Neither of us are actually too sure on the pronunciation, but that is sort of, as you said, the Americanized version. Pentti Linkola he died not too long ago, I believe it was last year. He was a Finnish deep ecologist and writer of ecology, but it's not ecology in the contemporary sense where we all have this super lovey-dovey, we all get along and it just works out via some magic words such as sustainable and, you know, eco-friendly and things like this. If you want to read someone who, in my opinion, truly goes to the lengths to say, no, you know, this is what we have to do, this is how we have to live, Linkola is your man. And it's not easy reading for people who are in their sort of comfortable Western lives. But Chad, you've written a book called The Later Philosophy of Pentti Linkola, which I guess is sort of done because the only other text which is translated in English is Can Life Prevail, which focuses on Linkola's early work. So really, we only have these two texts in English about his work at all. There's probably a few essays translated and things along these lines, and I've seen a few documentaries which he was in, been given subtitles. But so how did this book come about, and why did you decide to write it?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this discussion with you. One reason why I wrote a book on Linkola's philosophy is because the term environmentalism has basically become meaningless. Everybody knows that the same CEOs, corporate employees, media, Democrat Party politicians, and Hollywood celebrities who are the very worst defenders against the environment all somehow claim to be environmentalists just because it's politically correct to do so. Linkola actually does provide an alternative to this hypocrisy, but I think that Linkola's philosophy might be best understood through a comparison with an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents about a young man named Seymour plots to kill his aunt to get access to his inheritance, and he disguises himself as a fictitious person named Antonio Battani to do so. He feels he's committed the perfect crime until he realizes that when the police interview locals for details on Antonio, there's only one thing they can all agree on. That's that both Antonio and Seymour have the same large birthmark on the face, one which he simply spent his entire life pretending not to see. He was, however, the only one who couldn't see a birthmark which was obvious to everyone else. And on environmental grounds, one might compare this to when Facebook opened a data center in Upper Finland near the North Pole to unanimous applause by the global intelligentsia on grounds that this was the eco-friendly option, simply because less energy was required for cooling purposes. In reality, of course, the birthmark of ecological contradiction remained that even the so-called eco-friendly option still required enormous inputs of hardware which consume many times their weight in fossil fuels to be produced and then shipped across the globe, only to burn out rather quickly and then have to be replaced by even more hardware inputs. Social media giants think they've committed the perfect crime against nature and then gotten away with it by paying lip service to politically correct cliches of environmentalism, which are so empty as to be meaningless, but the birthmark of ecological contradiction is still really there for anyone with enough guts to acknowledge it. I think the 1980s Hollywood film They Live is another good a film reference to understand Linkola, because it tells the story of a man who found a pair of sunglasses which reveal that some of the people in the population are actually aliens sent to the Earth to take it over from within. In this sense, Linkola is basically the man who found the deep ecology sunglasses and is trying to expose the birthmark of ecological contradiction for the rest of us to see. In fact, the point of his work is to show that nearly everything that passes as real in our world is just an ecologically impossible object in disguise. Casey dissects them one by one, such as universal automation, universal sanitation, universal veganism, universal animal rights, and of course the worst one of all, global overpopulation.
So those we'll probably get into. I mean, I'm interested on the veganism and the sanitation. My favorite essay by Linkler, which I think we sort of have to touch on, which has become a meme, is the moldy jam essay, and him stirring the mold back into the jam, and this whole how he utilizes the concept of hygiene to realize how utterly ridiculous our sort of attempts to be sanitary are. But that might come. Actually, no, we could put that in now. I mean, perhaps we'll start with this sanitation idea, if you're okay with that, to sort of look at how Linkler, you know, sees ecology, sees the environment, sees nature. So, yeah, if you could expand on, you know, how Linkler sees sanitation, that would be great.
And so in a well-known essay called Humbug, Linkler observed that health inspectors have not actually made us more healthy. They have destroyed our health. It's proven, by the way, that first world people's immune systems have been weakened to the point that any Western tourist who travels to Egypt, Peru, Vietnam, etc., will probably get sick eating the same food, which locals have no problem with. This is something which I found out firsthand when I traveled to India for the first time years ago. On an economic level, universal sanitation also drives up unemployment because all of the regulations are just a euphemism for everything being at exactly the right temperature for exactly the right time, sanitized with exactly the right blend of chemicals, which is, of course, just a euphemism for a huge amount of money, which only a handful of corporate monopolies can afford. Even considered purely as a technology, though, universal sanitation is incredibly inefficient because some 40% of food produced in the United States ended up in the trash, even as some 1/6 of the population faced hunger even before the pandemic began. Universal sanitation is therefore something of an ecologically impossible scenario, which on a metaphysical level is devoid of being, but it's also deeply unethical and would be worthy of serious punishment in an ideal society.
Okay. So what do you think it is, you know, we live it, we in the West, we now have this compulsion, you know, we have this sell by day or use by day. And for many people, as soon as that use by date is over, you know, let's say, oh, it goes out of date on the 25th, today's the 24th, you know, the next day they're like, right, it's out of date. Even though that every one of their senses, you know, looking at maybe this package of bread or this piece of meat tells them it's absolutely fine. Where do you think that compulsion comes from to sort of give into basically just this artificial idea of perfect hygiene?
Well, I think it's a luxury of living in an era of cheap, easily accessible, abundant fossil fuels. This is the only thing which could allow an attitude which is historically anomalous, even compared to the recent past. Linkler's own experience in the 1950s of how fishermen would take their fish around town without having it at exactly the right temperature, exactly the right time, with the right blend of chemicals. Something which I see, by the way, on a daily basis here in India. I live on the coast of the Arabian Sea, where I see exactly what Linkler mentioned decades ago going on in the West. You still have that in the third world. And the reason is quite simple. We don't have the fossil fuel per capita in India that is taken for granted in the West. So we really couldn't afford this way of doing things, which the West also will not be able to sustain into the indefinite future.
Okay. You mentioned Linkler's fishing there. And I think one part of Linkler's biography, which is sort of important to mention, is he walks the talk, right? He lives in the same small hut his entire life, goes everywhere by bike or via horse, and is just I think he has like one plate, doesn't have washing up water or anything close to what we consider, you know, in quotation marks, modern. So in terms of people who've genuinely sincerely say they care about the environment, Linkler is in the very small camp of people who actually do.
Right. He actually came from an academic family, and everybody expected him to follow in his father's footsteps and be like an academic scientist. It's precisely because he learned too much about ecology that he realized he had to be a fisherman, a traditional fisherman instead.
Oh, I didn't know that. So for Linkola, I mean, we might have touched on these ideas when we spoke about Ted Kaczynski, but why for Linkola do we as a society dislike criticism of, you know, technology, of all these technological comforts that we've got?
Well, I think we dislike criticism of modern technology because modern technology allows the gap between pursuing what Linkola, basically my own term, an ecologically impossible situation, between pursuing it and finding out that it is not viable. This is something which modern technology allows us to maybe extend, but it does not allow us to actually overcome it. And therefore, modern technology is basically for Linkola what Kant would call metaphysics. It allows you to seem to overstep the limits of ecological reality, but it really just causes a certain transcendental illusion in which something seems to appear where there's actually just nothing.
Hmm. I don't know. Yeah, okay. I've never really thought about it like that. So in modern society, we sort of just use... But there's a belief there, of course, that we are going to keep going, that technology is always going to keep going, right?
Well, if you look closely at the kinds of solutions which modern technology offers, specifically for ecological problems, they are often just as bad as whatever they try to solve. When Jane Fonda, for example, was arrested in 2019 after flying all the way from California to Washington, D.C. to protest against the same global warming she was herself causing, she remarked later that she was relocating to D.C. full-time so she could get arrested every week, so she could be in the news every week. She claimed that she had to do this because she had already done everything else she possibly could for the environment, such as driving a hybrid car. She completely missed the point that electric cars are every bit as ecologically unsustainable, and the only viable alternative is to just walk or bicycle. Similarly, Thomas Friedman's Hot, Flat, and Crowded is a book in which she claimed that the solution to global warming could be as simple as having corporate professionals take one for the team by just using video conferencing software instead of flying all over the world for international business trips. In other words, he promised that Skype will save the world. But this fantasy actually did come true amidst the global lockdown, but we know a year later that people's overall consumption actually did not go down, even if they spent slightly less energy commuting to work. I think Friedman really just missed the deeper point that this expectation that anyone with a quote-unquote real job will have to do international business trips has missed the point that this corporate aristocracy of office drones, which he presumes are the only normal people, is itself parasitic upon a global technological system which is ecologically unsustainable and which will in fact guarantee human extinction if left intact. He can easily imagine a world of Zoom meetings, but he cannot imagine a world of agrarian peasants, let alone hunter-gatherers or nomadic herdsmen, despite the fact that these are some of the only ecologically viable options for the far future.
I mean, but this is sort of the double bind that people always find themselves in. I mean, it's funny that you mention hybrid cars. I mean, it's one of my favorite examples of sort of that modern day sort of spiel. You know, it is basically a Western society wants to eat their cake and have it too, right? They want to maintain the illusion that they're saving the world, saving the planet, saving the environment. But at the same time, they want the gizmos, the gadgets, the tech, which is the thing which is destroying the environment. So they still want to be able to drive, which is, you know, the primary thing, which is destroying the environment. But they want to do that in a way where they don't feel guilty. So they just buy a new car. And of course, you mentioned that third option is so abhorrent to most people. How about you don't drive? But that's abhorrent, right? No one, we can't, the problem we're stuck in is we deem ourselves unable to go back, right? We are in a society which just cannot accept return. Can't go, okay, you know what, we made a mistake, this isn't as good, we need to go back. And it's funny, I was listening to the radio the other day, and this is in the UK, and sort of some government scheme had given a £2 million grant to make this certain factory somewhere more efficient. And, you know, as soon as I hear that word, I think, oh god. But luckily for me, they'd given an interview to the manager there, and he seemed very honest, you know, in comparison to most people. And he said, oh, you know, this whole system is now in place. It doesn't seem as good as the way we used to do things so far, but we'll see. And, you know, there was this sort of, you could tell that there was this bind in his mind where, you know, he didn't want to have to sort of throw it in their face. But usually upgrade, innovation, improvement, we all know what this means. It just means things are going to get worse, but look better, right? Do you think there's, you know, there's something in that idea that we find it impossible to sort of return to a previous state?
Yeah, I think of a 2011 interview which Linkola had with Francisco Martinez and Larissa Venamo, in which they asked him why no amount of scientific information, which we don't exactly have a shortage of in the modern world, can actually get people to change their behavior. He answered with just three words, which were, as long as people still can vacation internationally or buy cars or shop in malls, eat fast food, they will. On a formal level, as long as any gap remains between pursuing an impossible situation and realizing that it can't actually be completed, we'll still continue acting out. And this is why Linkola actually associates desire with death and associates life with natural necessity.
Because these artificial desires, which are sort of created by or developed by corporations or businesses, these are the things which lead us to do things which are against our natural inclination.
Right. Desire for Linkola allows you to imagine anything, even if it's ecologically impossible. And desire really goes with language, because language allows you to construct an elaborate illusion, which eventually becomes indistinguishable from reality. In Linkola's terms, necessity is what has to adhere to the strict system of ecological law, even when it contradicts what we wish were the case. And the problem with democracy is really, for Linkola, that it is a political system based solely on this kind of desire. He noted in an essay called What is Majority and What is Minority, that partisan conflict in the West is actually largely an illusion. Both parties promise the same economic growth despite environmental damage, because both are held hostage to the same politics of desire rather than politics of necessity. He notes that this is not a contradiction of the ideal of democracy, because it's precisely when the right to vote is universalized that political parties realize that a numerical majority can only be acquired through buying votes with giveaways that are all eco-crimes in disguise. In fact, political parties don't even limit themselves to meeting pre-existing desires people already have. They actually work to artificially generate new desires that did not exist before, despite the fact that all of these desires are just euphemisms for a certain ecological impossibility in disguise. For Linkola, any political system based on desire is fundamentally flawed, because desire will always choose ecological impossibility. It will always choose the birthmark, if we consider the episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Only necessity will choose ecological form. And this is why democracy for Linkola is simply the political formation based on desire, and the green police, which basically force people to live on ecologically sustainable grounds, is a political formation of necessity.
Okay, and I mean, this is where probably most contemporary theorists or people who are working in the environmental field would completely switch off from Linkola and deem him, you know, silly, because he is highly, highly critical of democracy. And, you know, he emphasizes this idea of a government which gives us what we need versus what we want. And he sort of brings forward, I don't know if you'd agree, a form of like totalitarian. Or no, totalitarian is probably the wrong word, because they control every facet of society. I don't think he wants that, but he wants an authoritarian government which puts ecology as the primary, you know, the primary idea. So what do you think, you know, what's the difference then for Linkola between what we need and what we want? What do we need, I think, would be a good question.
Right. So a great example of how what we need and what we want are at odds with one another is a Linklater's own example that in an ideal society, wages would be low and the costs of raw materials would be high. This would maximize human employment while minimizing the use of resources and pollution. The mind of man, of course, doesn't want these things. He wants high salaries and cheap materials. And in the West, we have just mandated these things formally, and the result has been widespread unemployment and unspeakable environmental damage, pollution, waste, and actually a life that is less satisfactory overall, even for the people lucky enough to find employment there. In contrast, a government based on natural limitation for Linkola is something he's actually extremely specific about what that would look like. You note that you'd have to have a drastic reduction in a cereal grain production. You'd have to eat nutritious, though unfashionable fish, which can be sustainably harvested. You can eat some species of rodents also instead. You'd have to have a coordinated destruction of any machine which steals a person's job, no matter how convenient it might seem to be. You'd have to have food preservation be the job of individual households rather than of major corporations who, once again, waste some 40% of all food in the United States. You'd have to have localized transportation networks, even to the extent of criminalizing suburban sprawl and needless building construction. You'd have to rule out energy waste by literally making sailing against the wind illegal. Needless to say, there would be no personal cars because the only options would be walking, skiing, bicycling, or paddling. You'd have to stop producing plastic in the first place. Then there would be no need to find a way to deal with all of it. You'd have to remove house cats from many homes because they will hunt wild birds and negate even the greatest efforts at wildlife preservation in certain habitats. You'd have to destroy power plants with the full realization that the rest of the technological system will collapse as a result of intentionally tipping the first domino in an interconnected system. And of course, the most controversial is the world should be billions of people less populated, so you have to dismantle the myth of the freedom of procreation by having the Green Police grant licenses allowing reproduction only to those who have been deemed worthy.
Don't you think, though, that once you remove various facets and outlets of modern technology, that the growth rate would decrease, you know, naturally, because we no longer have all these sort of artificial apparatus allowing, you know, not to sound too pessimistic and realist about it, but not allowing those who normally wouldn't live to live.
Right. It bears mentioning that overpopulation is an ecologically impossible object in the very specific sense that, as Michael Rupert noted, it was forbidden by the natural cycle in which the soil could be replenished in agrarian context by only so much manure each season. It was only fossil fuels which interfered with this natural cycle and overstepped the limit of overpopulation. Despite the fact that it is completely unsustainable, even when examined on a quantitative level, some 85% of water consumption in the United States is by the agricultural industry, yet the aquifers they're depleting are only replenished some 0.1% each year by natural rainfall. Global population really cannot exceed 2 billion people under any other circumstances. So in very blunt terms, this means, as Michael Rupert noted, that a massive die-off is unavoidable, in which population figures revert to their pre-modern norms, if only by sheer ecological necessity. Linkola differs from other thinkers, however, by knowing that this reduction of human population might seem like the ultimate moral evil, but from an ecological standpoint, it would actually be the ultimate good, because in a very real sense, all of our other eco-crimes are parasitic upon this one.
Okay. So, in what sense then for Linkola would a sort of a Green Police, you know, what criteria would people have to meet to be able to be allowed to have children or be able to procreate?
Well, he has, a number of specific criteria. The fitness of the parents on many levels, intellectually is one. Physical fitness is another. Various things. But the idea that we have any alternative, I think, is a delusion. There really is no way out of respecting the limit of just 2 billion humans on this earth, however we get there.
So, I mean, you know, not to sound or try pigeonhole him or try be too hasty, isn't that like an eco-based eugenics?
I think that that might be an interpretation, but I think that Linkola is kind of ambiguous in this regard, and there's a number of different interpretations people might have about how exactly you would go about this. But once again, there really is no alternative. You know, certainly not sustaining 7 billion humans or even more than that.
Yeah, I mean, the data in square quotation marks supposedly states that it's the human population is going to plateau at 9 billion and then slowly decrease, but it's still going to decrease down to a number which is, you know, fairly high. So I don't know what Linkola would make of that. But one interesting question there, I mean, with just jumping back to technology is, of course, you know, people, modern society, I think, has this sort of illusion of or delusion of what technology is. You know, when you say the word technology, they think of super high tech things such as computers or cars or gizmos, gadgets, you know, Apple watches, these kind of things. You know, that's technology. Whereas pretty much, you know, a hammer is technology. So, you know, I think this is always an interesting question to ask for the thinkers which are dealing with technologies. What is the line for them? You know, what is the line for Linkola? Because obviously he had plates, he lived in a shack, he did use a trailer on his horses with reins, etc. So, you know, where is the line for Linkola where we can say, right, you know, this is as much technology as we should have?
Well, I think the line for Linkola is simply the criteria of ecological impossibility. It's quite fitting that Jacques Ellul, for example, noted that technique is actually not, or rather technology is not a set of physical machines. It was rather an artificial system of rationalization, which replaces a spontaneous free expression of nature with a coordinated method to maximize efficiency and adaptation. Ellul noted, therefore, the paradox that the machine itself depends upon the system of rationalization, because that alone can tell it its proper location as a cog within the whole system, rather than the other way around. At its core, for Linkola as well, technology is just a certain abstraction of linguistification, which is shockingly lacking in positive being, despite being thoroughly materialistic. I think that Linkola would group modern technology along with language, in that it allows for a certain unlimited madness, which is in contrast with ecology's adherence to a set of strict forms bound by natural law. It's for this reason that Linkola's emphasis on the negativity of modern technology as that which has failed the ontological test of being precisely because it is ecologically impossible, something I think we have to reject the temptation to describe this with Marxist cliches, specifically the Zizekian idea that this ecological impossibility is like the gap of the real or the abstract negation which sets a dialectic in motion by shaking the foundations of the current order and moving us forward to a more sophisticated stage. At the very end of his 2012 book, The Year of Dreaming Dangerously, Zizek actually did describe ecological crisis in exactly these terms. And he ended the book by noting that this emphasis on negativity for its own sake actually excused him and other communists from having to provide a detailed positive description of what the coming post-capitalist order would look like, for that would miss the whole point that abstract negation is exactly what provides the ontological conditions for this sort of openness to radical change. Yet this is exactly not how Linkola views the situation. This led Zizek to claim that nature does not exist because one can only be a materialist if matter itself is desubstantialized into an illusion which vanishes amidst the paradox that something can only emerge if nothing negates itself. For Linkola, on the other hand, nature is the only thing which does exist, because nature is not a set of isolated natural objects, but is rather a fully rational system of ecological law, which you can never actually overstep. You can only fall for a certain delusion of modern technology and a linguistification, which make it seem that you could. And therefore, although ecological impossibility doesn't exist, it's not simply a purely empty gap, which can only be described negatively. It's more like a linguistic message, which just happens to gesture towards a situation which can never be fully realized, kind of like how in mathematics, an asymptote will remain inaccessible no matter how close you seem to get to reaching it, but you can still describe it with a definite numerical formula. Although an ecologically impossible situation for Lincola can never be fully realized, it can still eat up an enormous amount of resources in the real world while you fall for the seeming legitimacy of it on purely linguistic grounds. And therefore, the birthmark is more like a virus than a gap of nothingness, plain and simple. It's a set of instructions which hijack the host and induce it to replicate a certain algorithm of death until the host itself is killed.
And this is why, you know, many of the contemporary feats to, you know, halt or help the ongoing environmental crisis, you know, these ideas of sustainability or eco-friendly or environmentally friendly, these are all largely just complete hoaxes, really, which buy into that same drive.
Right. You could consider the clean energy hoax as one of the worst examples of this. Michael Rupert noted that there is no alternative energy because each one is not just a new source. It's a whole new infrastructure because you can't store, transport, or burn the alternatives in a system currently used for petroleum. No alternative, however, is concentrated enough to pull itself out of the quicksand by its own bootstraps by providing enough energy to replace the entire infrastructural grid while simultaneously providing enough leftover energy to power everything else in the global economy, and by the most delusional claims, provide an even higher standard of living for all 7 billion humans. In fact, some so-called alternatives are actually net losers, which exist more for the purpose of making money off gullible investors and politicians than for actually providing a return on that investment. And this really makes sense because Michael Rupert noted that any claim to zero pollution is actually ruled out by the laws of thermodynamics themselves. These are just a marketing gimmick to dupe world governments into dumping tax funds into companies which will never actually make a profit, but can skate by on unearned wealth and promises they'll never fulfill. And therefore, it's not too different from a hamburger from a fast food drive-thru, which still really contains trace amounts of cow manure, but because they've airbrushed all of the taste, smells, sights of it, the clean energy gimmick also has all of the pollution costs there, but are hidden from the public eye and are accepted as a technological simulation simply because we're already living in one.
So the Green New Deal, not going to work, hey, Chad?
I haven't been following the news by choice, but I would assume that if it's being proposed by the Democrat Party and being praised by the corporate media, Hollywood celebrities and the like, I would assume it's just another ecologically impossible situation.
So, I mean, you know, I've sort of already touched on this question, and this isn't specific to Lincola, but why do you personally think we, you know, I think most people can admit to these glaring, you know, the emperor's, is it the emperor's clothes, you know, where the emperor's invisible, but no one wants to admit to it. I think driving down or being in the average traffic jam, most people can admit that this isn't normal. This can't be sustained when you think about it, but people go back into that sort of days where they just believe it. You know, what's truly stopping people breaking out of that? Is just comfort?
I think it's a fundamental mismatch between what I call the mind of man, which of course will always be held hostage by desire, and the mind of nature, which is really nobody's mind, but is a system of rationalized ecological laws, which are not to be held accountable to any one person's desires. And Lincola noted you can only have an ecologically sustainable government if it's founded not so much on any one person's opinion, but solely on this this mind of nature.
Huh, okay. And that, you know, that's why you state for Lincola that to be is to be ecological. You know, before anything, this is almost Heideggerian, though, that To be is to be ecological. Before anything, we have to understand and respect the limitations of our world, our environment. But Linkola takes this very seriously on a practical level, as did Heidegger.
Right. It has too rarely been noticed, I think, that Linkola's Can Life Prevail and Ted Kaczynski's Anti-Tech Revolution Weinhauer are remarkably similar texts in that each one provides something of a Euclidean geometry for possible and impossible objects, and does so on political rather than mathematical grounds. Kaczynski noted in Anti-Tech Revolution Weinhauer, for example, that a self-predicting social system would violate Russell's paradox because a formal system cannot use its own resources to talk about itself recursively. And what this means in the real world is that it's categorically impossible for any conscious agent to willfully steer the society in exactly the same direction he or she intends. Even if big historical changes do occur, they never unfold exactly as people envision that they would. For example, Enlightenment-era intellectuals believed that the result of technological automation would be that everyone would have enough free time to compose classical music or write, you know, Renaissance-style poetry. In reality, the boredom resulting from having all work done by machines just led people to binge on reality TV. Instead of having everyone become another Mozart or Shakespeare, people wasted their lives following every move by Kim Kardashian. On an even more serious level, no corporate CEO or engineer working to further technological progress on the ground level intends the outcome of that to be human extinction, but that's certainly what will happen if the current trajectory is allowed to reach its own logical conclusion. And whereas Kaczynski's background in pure mathematics led him to do this sort of test of whether something has being or not on purely rational grounds, Linkola's own background in the life sciences, as well as his experience living naturally, led him to do this sort of work on strictly ecological grounds by showing that nearly everything that passes as real in our world is actually an ecologically impossible object, which on a metaphysical level is quite literally nothing at all. I cite the example in the book of the super obscure 2015 dystopian science fiction novel, The Doors You Mark Are Your Own, as a ridiculous book which somehow combines the mutually exclusive themes of extreme water shortage and alcoholism. A story about a medical student who has to basically promise to solve world thirst just to get an 8-ounce cup of tea at a cafe, but then drops out of medical school and spends all of his time getting wasted in shady bars, planning a pseudo-Marxist revolution with his drinking buddies who are somehow able to waste limitless amounts of beer despite the fact that they're too poor to afford water. It's interesting that if the authors of this book had spent just 2 minutes researching the topic online, they would have realized that some 155 liters of water are required just to produce 1 liter of beer, so this situation is quite literally ecologically impossible. And it proves that even when we try to imagine an eco-dystopia specifically defined by the ecological problem of water scarcity, we somehow still take for granted that limitless alcohol availability for the poor is a given. Yet this is just a very unclear way of talking about a technological society awash in cheap, easily accessible, abundant fossil fuel energy, a certain modern technology which allows one to ignore ecological limitations, but only for a very short temporary period of time. I think Linkola differs from other ecological thinkers, though, and they points out that this is not merely a matter of epistemological curiosity, but of ethics as well. Ecologically impossible objects are evil for Linkola precisely because they're not real. They don't exist, but deceive us into thinking that they do. And it's once again because the mind of man is fundamentally out of accord with the mind of nature.
And this is why Linkola introduces the idea of eco-crimes, right? You know, if we're talking of an impossibility, in Linkola's sort of preferred mode of governance, there would be such a thing as eco-crimes.
Right. It's interesting that even Pope Francis was kind of introducing something like eco-crimes in a recent encyclical, but many Roman Catholics, I think, missed his point that ecological violation and sin are formally identical in essence. I think many people assumed that calling something a sin was just an arbitrary designation by the Vatican, which changes from pope to pope, in that eating meat on Friday used to be mortal sin until they decided that it wasn't, just as was the case for usury in the medieval era. But for Linkola as well, eco-crime is a formal designation of ecological impossibility, rather than an arbitrary designation founded on any one person's opinion. And if you examine many so-called rebellions against the eco-crimes of global capitalism on a purely formal level, they're actually just as bad in themselves. For example, last summer, the pseudo-accelerationist SJW rioters in the United States were trying to collapse the global capitalist system simply to become better consumers. They were destroying mom-and-pop businesses on Main Street just to force the government to distribute universal basic income so they could turn around and buy stupid junk online to be shipped to their houses, not realizing that this would only concentrate even more economic power into a handful of corporate monopolies in the technological industry. This is, of course, just an unclear euphemism for the ecologically impossible object of a universal automation in which nobody has a job, but everybody's still a consumer. Jim Rickards proved, though, that universal basic income is financially impossible because it would add some $300 billion per year to the national debt in the United States. Yet the Keynesian multiplier actually goes negative after debt-to-GDP ratio surpasses 90%. After a certain point, more government spending paradoxically inhibits rather than stimulates economic productivity. And USA is well past 100% in this regard, so this is no longer even an option. Yet even worse than the financial impossibility of UBI is the ecological impossibility, because Linkola noted that universal automation is just an unclear way of saying that we've already given the roles of producer, distributor, and seller to machines, and the joke is on us because the only remaining role is that of the mindless consumer, yet that's also the easiest to automate away. And after that does occur, he warns that only the sound of robots will follow, and then a deep silence, because we'll all be dead by that point.
And this is the learned helplessness that Linkola sort of mentions, right?
Right. There's a learned helplessness, specifically on a physical level, because the body itself has vanished amidst the abstraction of ecological impossibility, precisely because it doesn't really factor into what it passes as work today. You'll notice that an entire industry of recreational facilities has emerged precisely because people have to try to squeeze in exercise after work by doing the same work they refused to do earlier that day when they were clocked in. In 2012, one company decided to just cut to the chase by introducing the medicine directly into the poison by marketing a treadmill with a computer directly attached to it. Needless to say, though, the revolution of jogging while typing never really took off. But this shows that even in our attempts to try to be healthy, we cannot help falling into ecological impossibility. It's interesting that a medieval peasant could get plenty of work with just hand tools and the daily chores on the farm, but we now require enormous facilities such as winter sports in the summertime and indoor football stadiums in the winter just to play around in a half-serious manner.
Once again, it's an example of that sort of just being in a complete bind, you know, going to work all day and then driving 10 miles to the gym to then run 10 miles on a treadmill. Always made me laugh, but there you go. One thing I want to touch on, and I mean, you know, it's something that I think is a really great articulation of how Linkola once again thinks about nature and ecology, is actually his views on veganism, because I think obviously this is a touchy subject, hence why I want to bring it up. So how does Linkola view this, and how does he view, you know, our relationship to food? Because I think that's one of the most important aspects of his work is how we confront daily life and how we actually understand what it is that we need to live.
Yeah, I've noticed in my own experience of having video lectures on Linkola on YouTube, one of the most common topics to still get comments on is veganism, because Linkola does not think that forcing the entire world to go 100% vegan is the answer. And if you look at this for geographical reasons alone, you'll notice that it's actually impossible because much of the world's surface area is unfit for permaculture gardening of the sort currently fashionable among bolder hippies, but it is fit for grazing lands for livestock. Central Asia continues to reflect this with a diet heavy on sheep, goat, and cow. Linkola noted that not even the human body's anatomical features support any notion of universal veganism, as an unbiased examination of human teeth, bowels, etc. will reveal. Not even the problem of global overpopulation can be blamed on eating meat because it was grain surplus that caused this. It wasn't simple fishermen like Linkola. And by the way, anyone who claims that fishing is inherently unethical tends to forget that virtually every fish in the wild will eventually be eaten by some other animal. And it is precisely part of the natural cycle for that to occur, so long as one does not disrupt the natural process for the population to maintain itself.
It's a very good overview. I mean, does Linkola ever give any sort of practical advice to people who, you know, want to start towards a more environmentally friendly life? I mean, he's clearly quite cynical. So do you think he actually sees that as an option, you know, that individual efforts will overcome this? Or is he more of a, we need an absolute, you know, shut down the, we almost need like to put all the corporations on trial kind of thing? Is individual efforts even a thing for Linkola?
It's really interesting that Linkola explicitly endorsed centralized government and a tireless control of the citizens. He noted in a 2011 interview that media accusations that he favors dictatorship are not hyperbole at all. In fact, he openly admitted that even among dictatorships, the more draconian, the better. This is why he did not entertain any possibility that adopting green lifestyles on an individual level would be enough. If you do not address the central problem of human overpopulation, he noted that no amount of recycling, bicycling, organic gardening, or veganism will make up for the underlying problem of having 7 billion humans consuming resources, polluting, displacing other living things from their natural habitat. And you can only really have a global reduction in a human population on a coordinated level if you have this sort of centralization, which, of course, I think is the exact opposite of a lot of peak oil thinkers like you know, James Howard Kunstler, Michael Rupert, John Michael Greer, who do emphasize that sort of localized individual effort. Richard Heinberg is another. Linkola really is more on the other extreme, I think, of saying you have to have a centralized totalitarian, really a government, do this. Otherwise, the sheer problem of overpopulation will negate if one person is living sustainably, but billions others are not. It's really going to make it meaningless, unfortunately, for the ecosystem, the ecosystems on the global scale.
Whereabouts do you stand? Do you believe that individual efforts are worthwhile?
I think individual efforts certainly are worthwhile, but I think after living in the United States and then living in India as two sorts of extremes in terms of especially fossil fuel per capita availability, there really is something to be said for the system as a whole having to function a certain way. Many things which would be illegal in the United States are still taken for granted as normal here in India, such as, you know, the sanitation stuff that we were discussing, as well as just even keeping chickens in my backyard would be illegal in the city of Denver. Police would come and confiscate them, obviously, because they just want you spending way too much money on chickens from factories that lived in truly horrific conditions and are so unhealthy they have to be completely cooked, or you'll get very bad food poisoning from salmonella. But backyard chicken here in India, my experience, can be slightly pink because the chicken itself was not submitted to incredibly unhealthy and unethical conditions during its 6 weeks or whatever of life within some overcrowded factories. So there really is something to be said for the whole system having to function a certain way, because even if you try to live sustainably in a nation like the United States, my own experience is you'll basically have to hide from the authorities, who will punish you if you try to do things the right way.
Okay. Is there anything you would like to add about your book or about Linkola that we, you know, you feel is important that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, I think Linkola, I noted in the book, I called him one of the greatest thinkers alive today. It was interesting, I don't know the right word, that Linkola himself passed away about 5 days, I think, after I released this book. I released in March of 2020, and it was only about 5 days later that, you know, we got the news. And but I called him one of the greatest thinkers alive today, one of the greatest thinkers now, I would say, of, you know, recent memory, despite being basically totally ignored by the academic industry, which is still, you know, pumping out monographs on Freud, Marx, and Derrida as though that's something new. And I think it's precisely because Linkola is willing to say what is ecologically necessary precisely when it is unpalatable. You could compare him with Norwegian deep ecologist Arne Næss, who actually coined the term deep ecology, but wasn't willing to take it quite this far. If you read Arne Næss's work, he pays lip service to all of the same politically correct cliches regarding, well, you can only really be a deep ecologist if you're committed to social justice, right? And Linkola is not playing that game. And I think maybe one reason for that is he was living this lifestyle as a simple fisherman, which he was not held hostage by certain institutional forces, which will inevitably force even the best intentions to have to be watered down. And I think that's what makes him such an admirable thinker, in addition to producing such fascinating works, which I really look forward to the day that more of it is translated from Finnish into English.
Yeah, me too. But I think could be a while. I think I know a few people someone who's sort of learned Finnish to a basic extent to translate the videos. So there's clearly, you know, the sort of the diehard fans out there. But so we can find the book, The Later Philosophy of Pentti Linkola, by yourself on Amazon, I believe.
Yeah, there's a paperback edition as well as the ebook available now on Amazon.
Okay. Okay. Seems like a good place to finish up. So, Chad Haag, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.